Welcome back to the Man and Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ian Betts, and you have found us on episode 72. Very fortunate, as always, to have somebody who's been brave enough to lead in innovation and medicine join us for an episode. We've had some really great guests recently. If you haven't joined us for episode 70, we had Dr. Jose Mori, Dr. Anant Matabushi on episode 67, Dr. 68 was Chiara Langoni. And now we're fortunate to have with us a friend and colleague and someone who's innovating and being an entrepreneur. That is Dr. John Dayton. Welcome, John, to the Man and Machine Podcast.
Hey, and it's a pleasure to be here, buddy.
Awesome. So I'll give you a brief introduction in case the listening audience isn't familiar and they want to Google you while they're listening. But Dr. Dayton is an emergency physician and entrepreneur. He's very interestingly the first medical innovation and design fellow at Stanford's Department of Emergency Medicine. If that wasn't enough, he's had prior service as the president of Utah ASEP, founded Utah's Society of Physician Entrepreneurs. And one of the topics that I think we're going to spend some time on this episode of the Man Machine Podcast, is his work, not only as a physician, but advising medical startups and venture capital firms, starting his own to help improve medical care. Dr. John Dayton, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And so for the listening audience, if you're not familiar with Dr. Dayton, like many physicians who are entrepreneurs and innovators, they come to it with a very open mind of how do we help the patient? And like people who want to help, you look in all sorts of areas. You look at technology, you look at social needs, and I think you're a shining light for anyone who's looking to get into improving patient care, not just from the bedside, but from the large scope. So for the listening audience, tell us a little bit about why you've decided to spread your wings so broadly in your practice of medicine and how you think about helping people.
Sure, sure. Thanks again for the very kind intro. It's a great question when you phrase it that way. The example I like to use is if I'm in the emergency department and I'm taking care of a patient, you know, I can help them treat whatever the emergency is at that time. I can help facilitate the next stage in their healthcare. But ultimately that time is a little bit of a one-off, meaning that for that time period, I'm helping one person. In healthcare today, there's a lot of systems that can be improved, and there's a lot of things that can do through innovation to help more than one patient at a time. And so that's part of the reason I'm interested in innovation. And I you know, openly admit there's a little bit of a selfish aspect as well. I don't want my last paycheck to come with seeing my last patient. I want to innovate things. I want to bring things to market. I want to invest in things that will continue to help patients, but also will continue to help me financially when I retire from working in the emergency department.
Yeah, so there's a room for selfishness, I think, in human existence. It does motivate us in some ways. But obviously, your mission has been, how do I help this person in front of me? And then you're creative enough, like many of the other guests that have been on the show, to say, there are problems that I can help fix. So where do you think that came from you? Is that part of being an emergency medicine physician? Is that part of some other training or experience that you had that you said, I can do this? Because I think that's where people might need some direction. People think, I couldn't do that. And you're like, actually, I did it. So I think you can do it. So where does that come from for you?
Well, I hesitate to say, I do it so you can. I'm still trying to figure out the best way to do things. And I obviously have a lot to learn, but my experiences have come from either meeting someone that did something interesting and wanting to learn how they did that, but also wanting to meet a need or finding something that I could, some kind of process that I wanted to improve on. To just give an example, my first night working in the trauma ICU as a resident, I think it was the second year, I'm in Buffalo, and trying to get everything done, trying to make sure all the patients are managed. And the ICUs, particularly this trauma ICU, it's complicated. Some folks are ventilated. Mm-hmm. We're trying to manage people's vital signs, making sure everything goes well. And we had a patient that had Ludwig's angina. And for those that aren't medical, this is an issue with the soft tissue in your mouth, and your throat swelling up so much that it cuts off your airway. And so this guy was intubated. This patient was early in the morning. All of a sudden he self-extubated, meaning he pulled the tube out of his mouth. And I had seen the CT for this gentleman, and his airway was so swollen. I knew that tube was the only thing that was going to keep him safe. And so we needed to do what they call cricothyroidotomy, or poke a hole in the front of his neck, get access to his trachea, make sure he'd still be able to breathe. That's a tricky thing to do. And you combine that with the fact that this was a big guy and he was uncomfortable and he was realizing he couldn't breathe and he was a little bit disoriented. So it was a matter of trying to get the right equipment, trying to do some sedation, trying to get the right a nursing staff to help me. And we were able to get everything we needed to do. We did the procedure, we got everything in. But I realized at the time, wait, this is kind of a crazy situation. They brought me like a big plastics tray and brought me some other tools. And really all I needed was a tray cook and a scalpel and then a tube. Luckily we'd done a procedure lab, last week. So I felt pretty confident in doing it. So I did the procedure. Realized, boy, this could have been a lot smoother. And so in my mind, I started thinking, boy, if I just carry around like a pen size container, like when I was working in the ICU that just had a blade and a tray cook. And that way, if there was an emergency situation. And so I thought about it, and the more I learned about the process, I thought, this isn't really anything I can patent, because obviously these are someone else's devices. And so the packaging maybe has to be unique. And then we realized, how do we source this? And I started talking with IP lawyers and kind of figure out if this was a plan that would work, and ultimately decided not to do it. But just the process of this kind of got my wheels turning. And then when I started with my first group, I worked with a physician who had brought a couple medical devices to market. And not only had they been very impactful in helping patients, but he also had an interesting schedule. He basically worked because he liked to work. He didn't need to anymore. He was very financially stable. And I like to pick his brain during shifts on, asking him, what was it that made him think about these inventions? How did he bring them to market? How did he run that as a business while still practicing medicine? And then just different phases of his career. And so that was really interesting. And so in talking to him, I realized that that's something I wanted to learn more about. And as a physician, I kind of barreled my way through school, and my goal was just everything I needed to do to get ready for the MCAT, everything I needed to do in residency, because really you're just kind of treading water for those years.
Yes.
I have a lot of time, right? as physicians listening to the test. And so I realized, boy, I need to find other mentors. I need to find other education. And so I started looking for things like that. Around that time, there's a group called Society of Physician Entrepreneurs. And I connected with the founder, Arlen Myers, who runs that. And through this process, a colleague of mine, we set up the Salt Lake City chapter. And then we decided, hey, let's have meetings that are interesting for doctors that want to innovate. And so we focused on meetings where we had physicians who brought something to market come and tell their story. And then we focused on what are called pitch events, events where physicians that may be like the chief medical officer, or they may be the inventor for a company of like a healthcare device or a digital health tool, come and pitch that. And in setting up those meetings, I ended up meeting all the leaders for the technology transfer offices of the local universities. We'd have investors from different angel groups or venture capital groups come and judge. And they liked that because that helped them find new and interesting companies, and people that were pitching it liked it because eventually those were the people that they wanted to talk to. We had some kind of small prizes that were generously donated by local banks. But these groups, they wanted a lot of money to fund their R&D and their marketing needs and bring their tool to market. So they ended up being really fun events. Obviously COVID switched everything up. That was the end of mass gatherings. And and Society of Physician Entrepreneurs, or SOAP, has moved into a more online format where they continue bringing meetings that you can watch from home, which is probably nice. Nicer for folks, right? Busy schedule anyways. You miss something, you watch the recorded event. But I started looking for groups like that. And there's a handful out there that I really like. I like those SOAP events. Angel MD does pitch nights. And just to, you know, admit my own bias there, because I'm interested in what they do. And I'm on their board and I help them find the companies. And, you know, I MC the events if it's, you know, involving emergency medicine. And then I look at other groups like Startup Health that have health innovators, but have built really great networks, and they have phenomenal marketing. And so work with groups like these. And then in the process of doing that, people that would be in the community and thinking about doing some health innovation, a lot of times they would end up just getting referred to me, and I started doing some advisory work, and I realized this is fun, and I really like helping this company, but I want more formal training. And so as a result of that, I, you know, as I mentioned, I was a neuroscience major, you know, got to med school as quick as I could. I never did any business classes, you know, like I should have, and I think would have been really helpful. So I started looking at getting an MBA, and I was looking at which ones allow you to practice, but still, you know, offer a great education. You know, with MBA programs, you're looking at the value of being a network, but also the other value, you know, being the education, of course. Sure. And so I was looking at programs like, you know, Wharton does a weekend in Pennsylvania and also in San Francisco, and they have a lot of healthcare focus, and Hopkins does one online that's very healthcare focused as well. And so as I was looking at these, one of my colleagues reached out to me and said, "Hey, did you see Stanford has this new innovation fellowship?" And so I ended up applying to that, and that fellowship also includes an MBA. And so, you know, it seemed like a perfect fit. Obviously, that's a big jump to do, because to go back from being a practicing doc to going back to a fellowship and spending cash on an MBA education, taking a little bit of a financial haircut. But
sure.
At the same time, I think COVID really impacted a lot of us, and particularly myself. I thought, boy, these you know, contracts that we're working in, or situations, you know, are not being done right now with the physicians best, you know, basically people are making decisions for us, and they're not doing it with our, you know, thoughts and needs and priorities in mind. And I thought, if I have another skill set, maybe that's something that will help me, even though I take a pay cut for a couple of years, that I can, you know, work longer and you know, avoid burnout, which was sure. I'm sure on a lot of our minds as COVID started and continued to progress. So anyway, that's a very, very long-winded version of...
No, it's great. I really... Yeah, and I appreciate you giving that detail. So for the listening audience, if you haven't listened before, you know, we try to talk about innovations in science and technology and artificial intelligence in the practice of medicine. Dr. Dayton overlaps with many of those. And for any of those who are listening who might be medical students or residents or practicing physicians or just people who landed on the podcast, the very organic way that you described having an idea, caring for a patient, connecting with a mentor, you know, making other connections and having things come together, that's really, I think, how communities are supposed to function. Right. So it's not necessarily just about innovation in medicine, and you're certainly doing that and being an entrepreneur. But really, I think your story that you just laid out for the listening audience applies in so many parts of our day-to-day life that sometimes we forget. And COVID has created some barriers, but it's opened other doors. Like you said, you and I were introduced remotely. You know, for the listening audience, we've got video here, but at an Innovator MD event, and then through SOAP and LinkedIn and Twitter, you know, people are making these connections that they didn't have before. And at least my goal is to try to help as many people as possible as a physician, and maybe whatever else comes. And you're doing that right now. You're saying, I can be a physician, help the person in front of me. I can be somebody who can connect other people. I can be somebody who helps someone get an idea off the ground. And now, like you said, let me get another skill set that's going to help me be what I hear, one of the leaders, right, for years to come. So I'm hopeful that, you know, 100 episodes from now, you'll grace us with your presence again and update us. But I really appreciate you taking the time to lay all that out, because the listening audience will want to hear that again and again to get some motivation and some passion. So thank you.
Oh, you're very nice. I mean, I have to clarify, I am not your typical, you know, Stanford fellow. I'm not, you know, I'd like to think I can do something amazing in the future, and I'd love to come back with a brilliant success story. I feel like a lot of it, you know, we in medicine, we talk about like the imposter effect and like faking it till you make it, and how we get down on ourselves.
Sure.
And I think there's a mix of that, right? You have to be humble enough to say, boy, I don't know how to do this. And boy, I better read up before I give this talk, or I'm going into a meeting, I better make sure I'm comfortable with these terms, and, you know, low key Google search the things that I didn't get while I was there. And, you know, there's definitely a lot of that. But I, as you mentioned, I think that's why mentors are so important. That's why these communities are so important, because, you know, at the time when I was, you know, looking at starting this, you know, Society of Physician Entrepreneurs group and doing things like that, a lot of folks in medicine are not supportive of that. A lot of times our colleagues are like, dude, just work your shifts. Don't make any noise. We got a good thing going here. And it's almost surprising how many people are like, yeah, but you're a doctor, just be a doctor. But at the same time, I think that undermines the fact that we're very aware of pain points in our practice and tricky things we see for our patients with them navigating the healthcare system. And I think, you know, I feel like we're in a good situation to help provide the solutions. The other good thing, as I mentioned with burnout earlier, you know, if you, in emergency medicine particularly, if you don't have some niche, like if you're like an ultrasound guru, or you are a mentor for young educators, if you haven't picked out something like that, just statistically, and, you know, the academic literature shows, you're going to burn out. So you need to kind of find your spot to kind of help your profession and to help you, so that you can avoid burnout as well.
Yeah, and I think you're being humble, like many guests that I've been fortunate. Now, I do have episodes with, you know, my brother and an old friend, and they're not as humble. But you are quite humble in terms of recognizing that it takes a village, so to speak, to get to a place where you can be successful in whatever you're trying to do. And you can have a very, fortunate experience. Hey, I helped this one patient. Let me think how I could help more. I'm curious, you brought up a really good point. I want to get your perspective, and I hope that it's helpful for the listening audience who might be in medical training currently. This idea of just being a doctor, I think it makes a lot of sense 20 years ago. The world has changed so significantly, and we can be leaders in other ways. We might need some more education, like you're getting, or you might do at an MBA program. But how do you see, based on all this networking you've done, all the experience you've had, maybe how the future practice of medicine will be enhanced by having these dual roles? Is that kind of what you're looking at for yourself? Or is this something that you think could happen organically because we have very specialized skills and knowledge?
Yeah, it's a great question. I feel like, if you look at folks with dual degrees or folks that are physicians but have other skill sets, I think that, you know, as I mentioned, it's career longevity. You know, I think there's a major component for that. But I think there's a huge value for folks that speak, you know, different languages. And what I mean by that, in the emergency department, you know, when you take care of a patient with a broken bone, you need to be able to describe the orthopedic injury as an orthopedist would as you talk to them. If you're taking care of an OB patient, you know, you need to be familiar with how to describe an obstetric situation like an OB would to their colleagues. And so that's kind of a microcosm. And then you mix that with saying, well, if I understand business and I understand how to take this device to market, or I understand how this digital tool will help, you know, a large number of patients, or these, you know, remote, you know, wearables, and looking at the data and how that can, you know, help manage that patient. I think that makes, you know, that adds not just to your profession, but that helps your patient. It helps the group that you're practicing with. It helps the hospital with their outreach. And so I feel like the more kind of languages you speak, or the more you know, jargon or background you have, the more opportunities you're going to have to create a positive impact.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I appreciate the fact that we were connected because you took time out of your busy schedule a few months back to give me some perspective on what you were doing outside of medicine. And then fortunate enough that you accepted my invitation to come on the Man and Machine podcast. One of the things I was interested in diving a little bit deeper into with you is the idea of being an innovator. And as I say, kind of crudely, putting your money where your mouth is. This is something that I've started doing. You know, I think I've done it my entire adult life, but in terms of investing and saying, this person has a good idea. And it's not my idea, but I want to see their idea be successful. That's why I have, you know, invested in other people's ideas. Is that the mindset that you bring to it? Or is there something else to share with the listening audience of why an individual, whether you're a physician or not, might decide to invest? And invest can be monetarily, time. You know, I say there's time, talent, and treasure. Yes, we're talking about the talent and the treasure, maybe some of the time.
Sure. Yeah. So just a little bit of background there in setting up the Society of Physician Entrepreneur meetings and meeting a lot of these investors, one of the local angel groups in Utah, where I was living at the time, they said, you know, you do a lot of great research and figuring out these companies and gathering them and looking at their background. And really, that's what angel investing is. Someone brings an idea and you're looking at the feasibility. And something like that had always been kind of daunting to me. I thought, like, I can't do angel investing. You know, I have a medical background, but, you know, these guys have to understand a deal and an exit strategy and help the company with business development. But an interesting thing I realized is I kind of took a challenge to say, yeah, sure. They told me about a company and I did some background work. I talked to some of my colleagues that were specialists in that area. Tried to gain some more information and knowledge based on how they do the evaluation process and presented that to the other angels. And interestingly enough, they said, oh, this is exactly what we need. And I was very just upfront about my limitations. I said, guys, from the medical side, this makes sense. From the business side, I'm gonna leave that to experts. I'm not gonna pretend like I know how that would work. And they just kind of laughed. And you know, because a lot of times, doctors, we tend to be a little bit arrogant. We say, well, I'm really smart at one thing, so I'm obviously going to be smart at everything else. And
guilty. Yes.
And I don't know if it's our ego or I don't know if it's a community expectation or a combination of both. And so anyways, the group ended up saying, hey, you know, this is actually what we need. You know, 20-30% of what we get pitched is healthcare related. We'd love for you to join the angels group if you can help us do, you know, background on this. Because we actually have, you know, so-and-so in the group who's an exit of business development. And this gentleman, you know, helps companies ramp up. And this gal is actually perfect at building an exit strategy. And so joining an angel group was fascinating because I had, you know, my little niche, but there was other people in the group who were very good at what they did. And that's kind of how those groups function. People bring their interesting background together. And as a result, they're able to help these companies. And I think one of the reasons that works, you know, when it works, is because when you're investing in companies, you know, as you mentioned, you know, put your money where your mouth is. You're bringing investment to the idea. But I feel like I'm most help if I can, you know, not just invest, but kind of help on an advisory board or make introductions for the company or help them connect with other folks in the space. Or if I already know of a group that needs the, you know, the tool that they're bringing, and that makes a big deal, and it helps them get a pilot study and some research to help them enter other markets, and that's going to be really helpful. You know, as physicians, we're bookish, right? The same way we look at patients' background and we figure out a plan and a way to move forward. That mindset's actually really helpful for investing, to be able to look at the companies, see what the founders are, what kind of legal work they have in place, what kind of where they are as far as their development. You know, is it a great idea? Do they have what's called a minimum viable product? You know, do they have paying customers already? Do they have a pilot in place? Do they need help with, you know, research? Because that's our currency, right? We speak in evidence-based medicine. If someone has something and it's shown to work and they have a, you know, hospital or an office that's using that, can that be ramped up? Like they call it in,
right.
Like have you ever heard the phrase nail it and scale it, right? Have they nailed it in a place so that we can help them get a broader outreach and help help more patients? And so kind of tools that you have as a physician really help in that entrepreneur space. And that's, as you mentioned, that's how we met. The folks at Innovator MD were nice enough to ask me to give a talk on physician angel investing. And so it was fun to connect over that. And just a little bit of background on the talk, and you'll probably think
this sure.
About one of my first colleagues that I worked with was Jim Dolly, and he's the big guy behind White Coat Investor. And you know, he gave me a chance to write about that. And most folks said, oh, this is, you know, way out of depth for physicians. And this is something you should have specialized skill in. You know, you should use a portfolio strategy. You have to have a lot of investments so that, you know, one can take off and make up for the rest. And those are all very,
right.
very, you know, insightful and valuable points of feedback. But ultimately, even in that group, there were folks that physicians shouldn't do this, you know. Which is fair criticism. They, you know, they're up, maybe they say another avenue is safer for investment or things like that. But even in groups of innovative doctors and entrepreneurs, there's always a little pushback, and there's always a lot of reasonable feedback that you can learn from and get better at what you're doing.
Yeah. And I appreciate that criticism that we get pushed back on a little bit, that we should just be physicians. It is, you know, I think a calling for many of us, and it consumes a lot of our time and our effort. But I think the history of the practice of medicine has been giving back, right? So you can give back with individual that you're taking care of. You can give back by supporting a family. You can give back by being a larger part of the community. You can give back by being an innovator and an entrepreneur or an investor and saying, hey, I'm going to care for people at the bedside, and I like the idea that someone else has. I want to make sure that it helps them, whether it's with medical care or other strategies to help improve our day-to-day lives. I welcome that pushback, because I think that gives an opportunity to say there's more to us as people than just being a physician. We can, you know, as I said, put our money where our mouth is. And it doesn't mean to be showy. It means I'm going to invest in the future. And, you know, we're a future-minded podcast with Man and Machine and Archimedes International, the company that I started, you know, looking at the future of science and technology and artificial intelligence. And I appreciate you sharing that mindset, right? It takes a team, right? You can't know everything. Physicians think we do, or we think we know nothing, or we're vacillating somewhere in between. I have the imposter syndrome when I'm hosting a podcast. I'm like, what am I doing? But it's turned out well, because I've gotten support. I've educated myself, made some errors, improved on them. So I appreciate that perspective, John.
Yeah, that's a great example, right? That could be daunting to say, well, how do I get about folks that are really interesting in what they do? How do I connect with them? How do I build an audience? And obviously you're 70 episodes into that. You've had phenomenal guests. You obviously know, you know, what you're doing. There are a lot of steps along the way and things that you have to overcome. And you know, to go back to my criticism, you know, when I wrote that article for White Coat Investor, you know, people said, no, this isn't something that you casually do. You have to spend a lot of time. You have to learn, you know, learn aspects of investing. You have to learn how to evaluate a company. And that's all very fair criticism. You know, the joke for emergency medicine is that we have the best part-time gig in the world. If I do 12 hour shifts, I'm full time. That leaves a lot of the rest of the month. And so, you know, to be fair and to recognize that criticism, this is, you know, kind of, you know, starts out initially as my hobby, maybe a career transition in the future, but, you know, spending that time to do that. So, you know, an example of that, you know, you read a lot about how artificial intelligence will help medicine. We start to see applications already taking place and FDA approved AI applications. And I wanted to learn a lot more about that. And, you know, going back to our education, I studied neuroscience. I didn't study computer science or coding. I don't know any of those languages, but there are great resources out there. Stanford, Harvard, MIT all offer courses on AI and healthcare. And I took the MIT one, which is very case-based. It looks at, you know, different specialties in the hospital, how they're using it to help with their diagnostics, how they're how it helps guide research, how it helps guide future care. And one of the most interesting ones for me was how it could help direct flow in the emergency department. Mm-hmm. That's always the tricky thing for us. You know, we don't set 15-minute appointments. We need to be able to take care of all patients at all time that are in, that are, you know, in our doors. And we need to figure out how to way to utilize a set of resources for an always fluctuating number of acuity and fluctuating number of patients. And so I found that really insightful. And then there's another group working on building a boards for artificial intelligence. That's Anthony Chang out of California. And so I took his, right now it's not a boards course, but they offer a certificate. And that goes a little bit more into the background. You don't have to be able to code. You don't have to do these things that maybe not be in your wheelhouse, but it gives you an idea of how different types of machine learning and AI applications function. And understanding that's very helpful to say, you know, ultimately what it comes down to with a lot of AI is, you know, we do a lot of mundane and repetitive tasks that different AI tools could do for us. Yeah. Or we do something that we can optimize through AI. And so that was what I was hoping to get out of those. And so again, that just acknowledges, hey, I know zero about this, but I have a desire to learn and I want to just find a good source to get me there.
Yeah. And I appreciate that. I did take the American Board of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine Review course. I was fortunate. Dr. Chang joined me on an episode of the podcast. He's such a great innovator and educator and physician, you know, motivating individuals like yourself and myself to continue our education. You mentioned Arlen Myers, who's part of the ABAIM and started SOAP. So we are being influenced and mentored, not just in the day-to-day practice of medicine, but in how we, I think, build a future practice of medicine for the people coming up behind us, or even improving our day-to-day existence. So I did want to give you an opportunity to share something fun, because you, as you've mentioned, and I said in your intro, you're the first medical innovation and design fellow at Stanford's Department of Emergency Medicine. If you can give us a high level view of what you've done and maybe what your most favorite thing that's happened so far as part of that program.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a very unique program. It's over 2 years, has the MBA component, as you mentioned. So my time is split between working clinical shifts and teaching in Stanford's University Department, and then doing a lot of work with the digital health team. This involves some innovative work we're doing through video visits, and that was, you know, obviously has been a big thing during our COVID pandemic. Also evaluating tools for AI and digital health, and figure out, you know, care is shifting, the way that we're paid for what we do, the way we're measuring our outcomes, the way different generations seek healthcare, and trying to find a way to say, you know, where in this space is the emergency department going to fit, you know, in the future, and how can we manage that better? And then obviously spending some time on schoolwork. And that's funny in and of itself. Initially, the program was 1 year. And they called back and said, hey, listen, this is a new thing. We're doing it in our institution. If you're doing a fellowship, you got to get your Master of Public Health or an MBA. I said, sweet, get me into Stanford's program, because that would literally be the only way I could actually get in. And they said, no, we talked to them. And, you know, number one, you're too old. And number two, they said that you wouldn't be able to, you know, complete the rigors of the program with your clinical work. And I think that was probably a nice way of saying they presented me and the business school said no. And so I'm doing that program I mentioned earlier, the Hopkins one online, and you know, which is a great experience, and I can kind of do it as I want. But I have the opportunity to take classes through Stanford's Graduate School of Business, which is nice. I just don't get any credit for them. But one of the really interesting things that we're doing is, and this kind of goes back to the pitch events with SOAP, is we're building an innovation funnel. Dr. Ryan Rivera, who's the acting medical director, was a entrepreneur major, and he's brought a virtual reality based education company to the market. And so it's interesting to work with folks rather than in an institution where they tell you, no, just, you know, see your patients, don't do anything, to be at a location where, you know, that's what makes a professor unique, and that's what makes folks valuable to the institution, is that kind of background. But he's developed a what we call an innovation funnel. So he and I screen companies along with a couple other of our colleagues, like Dr. Christian Rose, and we evaluate. It breaks down to AI applications, digital health tools, medical devices. Those are kind of the big ones. And we have a goal to improve care at Stanford. And so we're looking for something that will help us stay competitive, help us treat our patients, but also help us add to the scholarly literature. And so companies come to us and they say, hey, we have this AI tool, but we need, you know, a data set to train it, and we need a pilot opportunity. And we evaluate whether or not that's going to make sense for our institution. And we have some approval and some funding in our department. And these companies go through a process. And if we do a partnership with them, and they go to market, or they're already in market, but we help with a different aspect of their plan. And, you know, in the future, like business schools do, we are going to have some ownership of the IP as well. So it's a nice a partnership setup. But that's been one of the most interesting tools, to see the kind of things that come to market, evaluating them, seeing how it's evaluated, not just in the healthcare side, but, you know, does this make sense with business operations? Mm-hmm. This makes sense with something that we can, you know, get published, you know, in our journals. So that's been one of the most interesting things. And that's, you know, a definitely unique aspect of training that it is specific to where I am. So I feel very grateful to be able to participate in that.
Yeah, well, I'm going to call you out for being humble again. I'm sure that you would have gotten into the business school, and I'm sure that there is equally appreciative that you're there as you are for being there. So, you know, we're coming to a close on episode 72 of the Man and Machine podcast, and I am excited already to see where Dr. Dayton finds himself whenever we get to our next episode. But did you have final thoughts for the listening audience, Dr. Dayton, in regards to things you're working on, things to be thoughtful about for the future of medicine?
Absolutely. I really appreciate the chance to kind of plug that. If there are folks out there listening that have an innovation that can help more patients in the emergency department, feel free to send it my way with notes from your show. I'm happy to list my contact information. Great. And then the other thing on the horizon is we're actually doing a pitch event. Some colleagues with the emergency department, Drs. Dan Embler and Jason Lowe and Ryan Rivera and myself. And that is going to be in May. It's going to be, we're calling it STEMIAX. It's going to be the second year that Dan and Jason have run this. But we're going to focus on AI in the emergency department, precision medicine, innovation in care. And we're also going to have a pitch event there with judges representing some of the big VCs in the area, including Andreessen and Horowitz. So we'd love to have folks tune into that. If they want to pitch their idea, reach out to me, because we're doing some screening for that right now. And love to stay in touch with your audience.
Great. Yeah. So we'll make sure that when this goes live on Twitter and LinkedIn, that people are able to find you and get connected and share their great ideas. Again, Dr. Dayton, thank you so much for joining us on the episode. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing for your patients, educating yourself, contributing to the community. So if this is the 72nd episode that you've been on the Man and Machine podcast, we thank you for coming back for all of them. If you're short one or two, I highly recommend going back and listening, starting at 67. We've had some other really dynamic guests. If you've dropped in every once in a while, another really motivating and inspirational episode here with Dr. John Dayton. But if this is the first time that you've listened to the Man and Machine podcast, sponsored by Archimedes International, we want you to remember that as we move forward, we're thinking about science and technology and artificial intelligence and medicine, and that the imagined fuels reality.